Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How much willpower do you have, and why does it rescue you from your unwise desires on some days and abandon you to them on others? Most of us spend hours every day resisting temptations and doing what needs to be done. The more we use willpower, the stronger our resolve becomes. But it turns out we only have a finite amount of willpower to tide us through a given day. So understanding how it works and when and why it fails us can give our long-term goals a fighting chance against our short-term impulses. Roy F. Baumeister is director of the Social Psychology Program at Florida State University and author of the new book Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength, which was written with New York Times science columnist John Tierney. Roy, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you for having me.
You liken self-control to a muscle, which means it can be strengthened by regular workouts, but inevitably, after heavy use, gets worn out. Can you talk about that?
Yes. The first thing we discovered that started us thinking along these lines was the short-term effect that after people exerted self-control in one sphere and something else came along, another demand for self-control, they did worse on the second, and that suggested something was used up or some, like the muscle getting tired. Later on, we got more findings suggesting that also like a muscle over time, it can be strengthened and build up, and this harkened back to the old idea of building character, which kind of went out of fashion in the early 20th century. But yes, you really can make yourself stronger in terms of being able to have more willpower and use it more effectively.
And if we only have so much willpower, there's also a suggestion that we can benefit by deliberately avoiding things that will test it.
Yes, the stereotype of self-control is, I don't know, Odysseus on the deck of the ship with the sirens singing, and he's fighting the temptation to steer his ship over to hear them on the rocks, you know, and that inner struggle and so on. But it turns out people with good self-control took a different way home and avoided the temptation. We have a large-scale study we finished earlier this year where people wore beepers all day for a week and trapped them at various times. And it turned out people with high self-control, although we thought they would be spending more time resisting temptation, they actually spent less time. And it's because they were less likely to get into those situations in the first place where they're confronted with problematic desires. So a bit of planning, a bit of arranging your life, a bit of using your willpower to create good habits, this is what successful people do.
What are the long-term differences between people with a lot of self-control and people who may lack it?
Oh, goodness. They are impressive ones. In terms of outcomes, let me just say by way of background, I started my career in self-esteem, and we thought self-esteem was going to produce all these benefits if we could bolster self-esteem. And ultimately, self-esteem disappointed. It didn't deliver the gains that we had hoped for, but self-control does. People with stronger willpower do better in school. They do better at work. They are healthier. They are wealthier. They are happier. Their personal relationships are better. Their own children are more likely to thrive over and over again. Essentially, psychology has found two traits that predict success in life across many spheres. Those are your intelligence and your self-control. And it's a lot easier to improve your self-control than your basic intelligence.
Is there a link between intelligence or IQ and self-control?
Well, there is a weak correlation. Partly, many tests of intelligence require you to use self-control. So to say to discipline your mind to focus and think on a reasoning problem and to avoid irrelevant information and focus on the right things and make yourself move step by step, that takes some of the same energy used for self-control. And so there is some overlap there. So it's hard to say if the intelligence as your raw power of your brain to think is really correlated with the power of your brain to, say, control yourself in self-control. But in practice, there's a substantial overlap between them. And we found after people have exerted self-control, even on a fairly minor way, a few minutes of controlling themselves, resisting temptation, controlling their feelings or whatever, they showed drops in the IQ scores if we gave them an IQ test afterwards. So self-control, even in spheres that have nothing to do with intelligence, can use up your willpower, and then cause a drop in your IQ score. It's temporary, of course, but it still shows that you need that kind of energy to think.
So I was interested to read about the relationship between brain chemistry and willpower. It turns out resisting temptation requires glucose.
Well, yes, glucose is a chemical in your bloodstream that's the fuel for a lot of what the body does. Your system takes the energy from food, converts it into glucose, and it's all food, whatever you consume that has nutritious elements. And then it goes to your muscles, it goes to your brain, it goes to your other organs, your immune system, your kidney, everything operates on this. But yes, self-control is a big user of this. So we found after you exert self-control, your blood sugar level drops temporarily. Hmm. You've got plenty to replenish your stores, but still there is a drop. And the lower your operative blood glucose, the worse you perform on intelligence and self-control tasks. People with blood sugar or blood glucose problems also tend to have self-control problems, and there are many links to this.
This also obviously has some interesting implications for people who are trying to keep their weight under control.
Absolutely.
You can't go around drinking a milkshake before every meal, but starving ourselves is bad too.
Yes. In the book we talk about this as the catch-22 of dieting, which is in order to resist eating food, you need you need glucose, but in order to get glucose, you need to eat. And willpower operates in step with glucose there. So, if you really want to come up with an effective strategy for losing weight and keeping it off, avoiding eating is not the thing, but figuring out the right way to eat so that you can get enough energy to keep your body going, but not the kind that will make you fat.
And then there's this thing that you call the Oprah paradox, which is that a woman who seems to have everything under control with regard to her work and her finances and her public persona still struggles to keep something that seems as simple as her weight under control.
Well, there are two things to point out here. One is that weight is only partly under your self-control. It is not fair to look at a fat person and say, oh, that person has poor self-control. It could be. But there are metabolic and glandular and other issues, and some people, even with excellent self-control and focusing all their discipline on eating, still cannot lose weight. So there are some things that are simply beyond the control. The other point is, though, if you look at people who have excellent self-control in many ways, and you'll find something that they don't have control over. Well, again, the point is we have a limited amount of it, and so people direct it into one thing or another. It's not that you have one kind of willpower for your work and another kind to be nice to your romantic partners and another kind to control your weight and another kind to quit smoking or whatever. No, they all come out of the same pot. So effective people kind of understand their limits and their capabilities, and they allocate their resources effectively, and they use it for the important things and try to skimp on the others.
Why is it, Roy, that long-term goals, things like staying fit or saving for retirement, are so often in direct conflict with short-term desires like buying that cool new phone or eating a bag of chips?
Well, good question. That seems to be how the universe is set up in some ways. But it's something I want to point out, an evolutionary perspective. This is rather new. Most animals can't think more than a few minutes. Most animals can't even think of more than a few seconds into the future. Huh. So we humans are almost uniquely able to make long-term plans and face this kind of trade-off. Do I want to save something for the future versus have it now? Even basic things like farming. Well, you're going to take some of your grain and instead of cooking it and eating it now, you're going to bury it in the ground and try to grow crops for future time. Mm-hmm. And you'll have more in the long run, but less in the short run. Well, that's how things are set up in many respects. And so willpower has enabled the success of our species. And in our book, we call it the greatest human strength. But it means using it to pursue what's your enlightened self-interest, which means what's best for you in the long run, not necessarily what's best in the short run.
So is the fact that we still have a component of that sort of lizard brain that wants it right now, despite what's going to come later, is that just a holdover from evolution, or is there, in fact, perhaps a benefit to sometimes giving in?
Well, I'm not one to disdain the benefits for giving in sometimes. We have to live life in the present now and then and enjoy the things. But I think the first point is more correct. Yes, the nature made us to take advantage of the present. The brain added throughout evolution, just added on piece by piece on top of the old. It didn't get rid of the old parts to replace them with new ones. It simply added new ones. So that ability to think ahead and to override your immediate impulse to do what's best in the long run, that sits in the brain next to the, as you guys call it, the lizard brain part that says, just give it to me now, and I can't think ahead of the next 30 seconds. I remember evolution started with, the brain evolution started with, this is pain, this is causing damage to my body now, let me get out of here. Locomotion and exertion, moving around and eating, locomotion and digestion, rather, eating and moving around were the basis of the brain and the central nervous system. That's what got that started. And those are all very immediate things. Long-term planning is a much later addition onto it. But like we said, it's the holdovers are very much there.
What makes really careful monitoring of our bank statements or the scale or whatever else it is we're trying to achieve, what makes that constant monitoring so helpful when we're trying to stay under control?
Oh, excellent point. Well, monitoring is part of the cycle of self-control. It's almost impossible to control something that you're not aware of.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that easily at the government level if it wants to control how people are making buildings or making sausages. It has to get reports or have to have inspectors or has to do something. It can just make the rule and hope people obey it. So in your own life, the easiest way to improve anything you're trying to control, the first step is to keep track. So if you want to go on a exercise program, you got to write down every day, did you exercise, and if so, what did you do? People who want to do an effective diet start counting their calories and keeping track of what they eat. If you want to control your spending, you start to keep a record of how much you're spending, what money's coming in, and what money's going out. All that already just helps. As I said, it's very hard to keep track. It's very hard to control anything without keeping track of it.
It's remarkable, though, the extent to which we're able to sort of deceive ourselves. I mean, people must be aware that they're going to have a big credit card bill at the end of the month or that they've put on a few pounds because their clothes aren't working or whatever. But there's something about that confirmation of what we might suspect that makes a difference?
Yes, I think you're right. People will have the sense that they spend them out on a credit card, but it's very hard, unless you're keeping track every day and writing down and so forth, how big that's going to be. I think people had less of these problems of getting hugely into debt before credit cards, when you operated pretty much with cash and perhaps a checking account that you balanced each time and you added up how much money was left in the checking account. And you knew how much money was in your wallet, and you just didn't spend any more than that. That prevented people from getting into problems because it enforced a kind of keeping track. Whereas with credit cards, you can spend, it doesn't seem all these little expenses really add up into a big one. And that's another of the short-term, long-term paragraphs. With cigarette smoking, for example, no one cigarette's going to make you sick or even increase your odds of disease very much. And so it's always rational to have one more cigarette, but the accumulated impact of all those really sets you up for some serious health problems. So you need willpower to treat each instance, each moment, as if it's part of the general pattern.
My guest is Roy F. Baumeister. He's director of the Social Psychology Program at Florida State University and co-author, along with John Tierney of the New York Times, of the new book, Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, maybe share how you exercise your willpower, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director of the Social Psychology Program at Florida State University, Roy F. Baumeister. He is co-author of the new book, along with John Tierney, Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Roy, is there any difference in the amount of willpower needed to complete a less than appealing task that, as compared with turning down a very appealing treat?
It's the same kind of energy. It's the same resource that's used. One might take more than the other, but you couldn't say just on that which one it would be. And it might depend on which is more tempting or which is more difficult or how much time you spend making the exertion.
How about fear as opposed to rewards in terms of motivating correct behavior? Are they the same?
Fear and rewards. Well, that gets into another issue. This is a general principle that bad is stronger than good. It isn't popular to say that. We want to switch our schools to use only rewards and not punishment, or only praise and not criticism, and so on. And, you know, those certainly make them nicer. But children learn faster from criticism than from praise, and from punishment than from reward. And they learn fastest with both, judiciously applied. There's no question there's the most information if you use both.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. This job that I have requires a lot of preparation ahead of time because I have to know what I'm talking about when I interview people. And as much as I truly enjoy the process, I think that my fear that I will humiliate myself is really what keeps me in the chair when I'd rather be doing something else.
Yes, fear is a good motivator. Like I said, we don't like to admit it because it's not as pleasant as thinking about rewards. But yes, it really works.
How are our brains affected by our tendency to procrastinate?
Well, procrastination is another willpower issue. It goes back to a couple things we were talking about before: the short term versus the long term. Hour by hour, it's probably always more rational to do something fun than work on an unpleasant task that's not due till next month. Mm-hmm. But if you make that decision every hour, you'll get down to the last minute. Procrastinators do poorer quality work. They also suffer more stress in the long run. They suffer less in the early stages. A pair of studies, actually, that we ran some months ago looked at students who were procrastinators versus those that weren't. Early in the semester, the procrastinators were healthier because they're probably out going for walks and playing Frisbee and having a nice time while the others are buckling down. And so the others were a little bit more under stress early in the semester. But late in the semester, the procrastinators were so much sicker that it even canceled out and overcame the advantage they had before. So the total effect of being a procrastinator was negative on your health.
So it still weighs on us when we haven't finished something we need to do.
It still weighs on us. It bothers some more than others. And you can't do as good a job at the last minute. Most things, there's something called the planning fallacy. You know, think when was the last time you heard of a highway project or a building or something coming in being done 2 months early and under budget. Most things just take more time and energy and resources than it seems like they will when they plan. Therefore, if you leave it till there's just enough time left at the end, there isn't enough time. Mm-hmm. You're not ready for things going wrong. There are studies even where they ask students to predict how long it would take them to do their thesis, and they made best case and worst case predictions, and the worst case in which if everything possible that could go wrong did go wrong, how long would it take you? And in reality, that took them longer than that. Even those predictions were unrealistically optimistic, the most pessimistic predictions they could make. So procrastinating sets you up for problems. And to get back to the self-control issue, procrastination is one, people with high self-control have less stress in life. People who manage their lives effectively, and it's because one of the sources of stress in life is your own screwing up. So you leave things to the last minute, and then you find out you don't have enough time, and then you have to stay up all night working or scramble around to get the book or whatever that you couldn't get or the information. So you create all that extra stress for yourself, and while you're coping with that, you're neglecting other things too. That's sort of the way the person with poor self-control or low willpower struggles through life and is constantly, you know, it feels like you're getting clobbered by the outside world, but many of the problems are indirectly of your own making. So we try to show ways that you can use willpower and self-control to your advantage to avoid these problems. First, recognize the problems in planning, get started on things early so you don't end up in these difficult situations. We call it playing offense, not defense. Use self-control to set up good habits rather than to bail you out of trouble.
I was interested in reading here the suggestions about specific ways to make a to-do list. For example, if you know that you need to write thank you notes after a party or something, one might think write thank you notes is sufficient to remind you to get this done. But if you don't have stamps and cards, you ought to put down buy stamps and cards before you get to the writing process.
Yes, my co-author John Tierney did a lovely interview with David Allen and is getting things done, and we cover many of the highlights of that in one of the chapters in the book on the to-do list. He said people make a to-do list and they'll put something like mom on there. And he'll say, okay, what do you mean mom? He says, well, it's her birthday. Well, what do you mean it's her birthday? Well, I got to do something about it. Well, what do you mean by that? Well, I got to figure out what I'm going to get her. and so for the to-do list, make the first action step, the first thing you're going to do. Otherwise, you don't really have a clear plan, so you keep putting it off. And second, it will keep your unconscious keeps bothering you, and you'll keep having those nagging thoughts, what about mom, what about mom? But when you have a specific plan, okay, the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to figure out what to get her, and then I'm going to go and go to the store and actually get a present.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I need to go shopping for the present, but Tuesday afternoon at 3 o'clock I have an hour off, and then I will go to Macy's, and there I will get her some perfume or whatever you're going to get her. So once you have a specific plan, then that stops preying on your mind, and you can turn to other things, and then when Tuesday afternoon comes around, you can do that. That's much less stressful than just having mom's birthday on your to-do list, and, oh, I got to figure out what that means and what to do about it, and, oh, I can't figure that out now. That's much less helpful.
You also have a potential solution here to those annoying songs that get stuck in our heads, which I suppose are a similar mechanism because we've only heard a snippet of a particular song, and so we are forced to hum it throughout the rest of the day, even though we can't stand it.
there are plenty of tips we came up with. The psychology knows something called the Zeigarnik effect, which is the things that are interrupted. They keep coming back in your mind because your unconscious has the idea that, oh, we should finish that. So if it's the annoying song, once it comes on, let it play all the way to the end. Whereas if there's a song you love, paradoxically, you should turn it off in the middle when you hear it on the radio, and then it will keep popping back into your mind the rest of the day.
My guest is Roy F. Baumeister. His new book is called Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Sherry in Dallas. Hi, Sherry.
Well, hi. How are you doing today?
Great. Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks for allowing my call. I have a question, a comment, then a question. Most of my life, I've had very strong willpower, and I attribute that to my parents' upbringing to teach responsibility and instilling values over time. But I have had a weight problem most of my life, and it's been the yo-yo effect. I've recently lost about 35 pounds in the past few weeks, which has shocked all my friends, by just going on a raw food diet, you know, fruits and vegetables and, you know, a smattering of protein. Well, most of my friends know me as, they call me voluptuous. I just think I'm large. And so they're very surprised to see me just, you know, slimming down, going down like 4 pant mm-hmm. sizes and that. So my question is, when those intervening years occur, I almost go into like, not denial, it's kind of a, I don't know what it is, a brain freeze, where I lose my willpower or I ignore my willpower that I know that I have and that I can tap into.
Any insights there, Roy?
Sorry?
I think we got your question. Thank you very much, Sherry. And any insights into what Sherry might be coping with?
Well, there are several things. For one thing, when your weight goes up and down, your body learns to resist losing weight. Remember, we evolved in times of shortages, not surpluses of food. And so, yes, they've done these studies with rats, too, that controlling their diet to make them gain and lose weight, and each time they gain faster and lose more slowly, and after a couple rounds, they just won't lose it anymore. So it ceases to be something your willpower can really work with once you've gone up and down several times. That's we suggest trying to make permanent changes in your eating plans rather than dieting and then going off and gaining it back. Also glad to hear the parents instilled a lot of willpower, which is good in most respects in life, and it is one of the best things, one of the best gifts you can give your children is good self-control that will lead to success in their lives in many ways, in many different spheres, personal relationships, and work and studies as well.
You also describe here something you call the what the hell effect, which is basically once I've blown it, I might as well enjoy myself. And I guess that can be a diet or spending or a million other things.
Oh, yes. This could be maybe part of the brain freeze that that Sherry there was talking about. Some researchers in Toronto did this some years ago. They would have people come to an experiment and have them not having eaten for several hours before. And then some of them did the experiment where they were tasting foods and so on without having getting anything to eat, and others, they filled them up first. Now, normal weight people, if they had eaten a lot first, then they would just nibble at the crackers for the taste test because they didn't want to have too much more, whereas if they hadn't had anything to eat, they were starved and they would gobble through. But the dieters showed the opposite pattern, and they called it counter-regulatory eating in the publication, but yes, it was the what-the-hell effect was the informal name in the laboratory, because the dieters are acting like, well, what the hell, my diet is blown for the day because I ate that milkshake, so I guess I won't be back on the diet tomorrow. I might as well enjoy myself and have all I want. But that's the unfortunate thing, because breaking the diet isn't what really, going over the line isn't what fattens you up and ruins it, but eating a whole lot more on top of that, that's what's really going to set you back and put on the weight again. It's better to go a step or two over the line each day, but having the big binge and just turning off your willpower and ceasing to count what you do. Other work showed that's what happens in the, to use the brain freeze expression again, to these dieters. Once they get across the line, they stop keeping track of how much they're eating. They think, okay, that's it. I'm over my limit for the day. So what the hell, and I'm not even going to look anymore. And then they don't keep track, and while they're not keeping track, they'll eat a huge, inordinate amount.
I want to go back to kids, because they've come up a few times already this hour, and you know they come into this world wanting what they want when they want it, and we have to sort of wrestle that away from them a little bit. And it turns out a lot of the little things we bug them about, sitting up straight at the dinner table and using proper grammar and using a napkin or whatever, those are actually good ways to build their self-control.
Yes, it's ironic. I grew up in the 60s and 70s when we were all rebelling against all those arbitrary rules and you're supposed to do your own thing and let it hang out and so on. And yet now my research has taught me that, well, conforming even to arbitrary rules like standing in line and having your posture and so on, those are small exercises in self-control that will build up your capacity to control yourself in more important ways. It's also like the justification given for sports. Many people say, well, by participating in team sports, which have, you know, very little inherent value, you can learn values and build character and learn strength and life lessons for other things. And yes, that appears to be true if it's handled that way. Taking on the discipline to practice a sport regularly, respect the rules, be a good sportsman or sportswoman, and also keeping the discipline of training regularly and monitoring your progress. All those things are indeed good preparation and will improve your capacity to cope with important challenges in life and family and work and so forth.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Jane on the line in Dallas. Hello, Jane.
Yes, I'm interested in the nature-nurture question. There are families that are well-disciplined and instill self-confidence, self-control in their children, and then there are those who don't. But I'm curious about how much of the self-control is inheritable and how much is just due, like if the second generation is well-controlled and self-disciplined, is that more due to the traditions that were established in their home, or is there an inheritable tendency towards self-control and discipline?
Well, that is an excellent, profound question. I can't give you a complete answer to that because the research is still ongoing. My bet would be that there is some genetic heritable aspect, because there turns out to be a heritable aspect in most psychological traits. But perhaps the more important is exciting news, there's definitely an effect of training. In some of our studies, we were able to take people and grown-ups, within a couple weeks of having them do exercises like posture or like improving their speech and grammar or things like that, simply to make minor changes in themselves, that improves their willpower, that will show up on tasks having nothing to do with what they practiced, abstract laboratory tasks, or even in their own lives. Many of them track them, and they notice the difference that it produces a benefit. So the nurture part is alive and well and thriving. I'm guessing there's some nature part. Actually, I'm not a behavior geneticist expert, but my sense of, as I keep up with the research literature, there's been a shift from thinking things went straight from genes to behavior. Now most things turn out, even most genetic effects, turn out to be interaction, so that the gene prepares you to respond to things in the environment. So even the genetic part might take some encouragement. And that's why we would see these family effects that you pointed out, where some families will show consistently better self-control across generations than others, that perhaps they're starting with some genetic capability and then by their practices are bringing it out in each one. To be a parent who brings up effective, strong children and instills self-control in your children, the parent has to set rules and enforce them consistently and so forth. So it takes self-control in the parent to instill it in the child. Again, nature-nurture combination. But there appears to be enough pure nurture that this is a great avenue by which we can all benefit and improve people.
Roy F. Baumeister is my guest. He's director of the Social Psychology Program at Florida State University and co-author of the new book, Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. Join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, here this hour with Roy F. Baumeister, who directs the Social Psychology Program at Florida State and is author of the new book, Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Fascinating question here from Ed in Dallas, who writes, "In one way, I have a lot of willpower. For example, I started marathoning at age 63 and I'm training now for my fourth. But I've also realized that sheer willpower has led me to hold on stubbornly in situations where I become self-defeating. It seems to me to be a classic case of the things that are our virtues and that lead to real achievement also being the things that are the greatest sources of our failings." What do you think about that?
Well, I think willpower does a lot more good than harm, but ultimately it is a tool. And like any tool, it could be used in destructive ways. So yes, hanging on to things and being stubborn, but you can overcome being stubborn, but using willpower for that as well. We, in our research, we have looked for negative effects that go with trait self-control, and we have measured this and looked for it. And I would really like to find some because it would make the theory more interesting, but mm-hmm. Really we have not found them, that having the capacity to control yourself, the more you have, the better off you are, the better your relationships are, the more successful people are around you, so on and so forth. Its effects are mostly pretty good.
What can we learn about willpower by studying people who have coped with problems like gambling addiction and shopping addiction, if you accept such things as addictions, that are not necessarily chemical in nature, but do pose a real problem for people?
I think that's a very fertile area to look at. The term addiction originally meant just you liked something a lot, and over time they talk about the chemical versus the non-chemical addictions and whether there are withdrawal symptoms or not and so forth. And there's a lot of controversy about how exactly what should be called addiction and so forth. But no question, people show similar patterns of getting caught up in liking something very much to the extent that they let it interfere with their life. And that's a new additional meaning to addiction, that it has some negative consequences for you and causes you to do stuff that isn't good. So, just being addicted to being a nice person would not be a problem.
Right. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Annie in Arlington. Hi, Annie.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
I had a question for. I wanted to know how can parents make if the parents have a poor self control and they can make it. The ways they can tell their kids to have a good confidence and self-control. So I just wanted to know that. And other thing I wanted to, my second question is that when I plan everything, even though I had a day ahead, even what I have to cook, even though everything, like I plan everything, but like it's like the other family members and the friends, they said like, why do you test out? Why do you, worried about the next day, and why do you plan everything? You just wake up and do whatever you wanted to do. So I just had these two questions.
All right. Thanks for your call. Maybe we can start with the question about those who have a lot of self-control can't always communicate to others why it's so important to them.
Yes. And that's when you're in a social circle like that, you'll end up taking care of them most likely. Mm-hmm. The benefits of planning ahead and doing things that are useful in the long run rather than going for moment to moment is that you really get somewhere in life and you're in the long run, your outcomes really are better. That's what has set us apart from the animals who, by necessity, all live just from day to day and can't do things to plan for the future or adjust for long-term benefits or build a kind of culture where they will accomplish these things. Just showing them, you can see after a while that the people who work ahead for the long term, they do get ahead and they have nicer places to live and make more money and are more successful and so forth. Persuading others that they should change, that's hard in some cases. And if they're people you love, you don't want to ruffle their feathers and so on. And so you need to perhaps let them be the way they want, but don't let them drag you down and impair you from getting ahead.
And at the risk of repeating ourselves, with regard to kids, you write that it's really important to force them to build their self-esteem based on achievement as opposed to just being who you are.
Yes. We had the idea for a while that just boosting self-esteem would make kids into better people. There were correlations. For example, children who get better grades in school have higher self-esteem. And so we thought, okay, well, if we can boost other kids' self-esteem, they'll do better in school. But it doesn't work like that. Self-esteem is mostly a result, not a cause. So getting good grades in school leads you to get high self-esteem, but having high self-esteem does not lead you to get better grades in school. Hmm. Therefore, the important thing is to work on the grades first, then self-esteem will follow along, and use that as a reward. That's a nice incentive. People like to have high self-esteem. They like to feel good about themselves, but you want to teach them to earn it, not that they're entitled to it.
Let's go next on the line to Ian, calling from Allen. Hi, Ian.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question relating to group dynamics and how it can affect personal willpower. I'm thinking of cases like Alcoholic Anonymous or even protests in Libya where people are willing to risk their lives. Otherwise, in other situations, they wouldn't.
But yeah, what about that support factor, Roy?
That's human nature. We depend a lot on others. We evolve to cooperate and work together and interact and communicate. We care very much what other people think. So you definitely can use that to bolster your own willpower. It's easier to fool yourself than to fool other people. So when you're trying to tell yourself how much you exercised or whether you dieted or whether you quit smoking or quit drinking. Well, having a group of people who will follow you, and they will want to know exactly how many days, they will notice your lapses and call attention to them. And so, yes, people work better when they share their self-control projects with others and get other people aware of them and knowledgeable about them and invest in them. So AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, to what degree it is successful, and it looks like it is moderately successful and as good as the paid professional treatments for alcoholism. Much of it seems to depend on being part of that community where you have other people checking up on you. You go and you report to them how long has it been since you last had a drink. You don't want to let them down, and that gives you an incentive not to to cheat and here and there, and not to infringe. So, yes. But that's a basic part of human nature. It can be harnessed to be beneficial in connection with the willpower.
So many religious traditions require people to exercise a great deal of willpower over their impulses. How helpful is it to be tied into a system of beliefs that that really says these things are vital?
It is quite helpful. It's not indispensable, but it is important. And I people have many views, so let me say right out, I am not religious, but I respect religion, and I am an admirer of what it has contributed to society over the centuries. And one of the benefits is that, and it's clearly shown in careful studies, religious people in general have a little bit higher self-control than average. There are other paths to self-control, but religion helps in multiple ways. It helps by what we were just talking about, that you're part of a community that kind of keeps tabs on you and encourages you to do well and notices when you start to slip. Religious people avoid some of the bad behaviors that contribute to health problems and so forth. Religious exercises are also those little exercises in discipline. And we talked about working on your posture or things as an exercise to practice self-control. Well, making yourself pray every day, making yourself get dressed to go to church now and then, making yourself meditate, whatever your participation is. Again, controlling your behavior to conform with these exercises, even if they are completely arbitrary, that does build character and does contribute to strengthening your capacity for self-control in other ways, too.
What about teenagers? You remind us here, not that most of us need reminding, that they have you call it a child's self-control and an adult's wants and urges. That is a terrifying combination.
Yes, well, that's what happens in childhood. Your mind keeps pace with your body, more or less, and you have the amount of self-control, depending on how much your parents in school enforces you to have some discipline and control so that you can manage it. And then suddenly your body changes and the reproductive system kicks into adult gear, and with it come aggressive or competitive impulses and other things going on. And it takes a few years for the psyche to catch up and develop self-control. So the important thing for society is to work with an understanding and work with the teenagers to recognize there are going to be some problems. But what is the goal here? It's to improve the child's ability, or the young person's ability to control himself or herself, to develop the greater self-control, to hold these disciplines in check and find ways of satisfying them that are consistent with the rules of society.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Bill on the line in Irving. Hello, Bill.
Hi. Could this be cultural, self-control be cultural? I moved from northern Ohio to the city of New Orleans after 3 years. There was a bias against self-control and eating, drinking, and other sorts of merrymaking.
In New Orleans, you mean?
That's right.
What about, there's a lot of temptations in New Orleans, too.
Yes, certainly the cultural aspect is definitely there, and different cultures have different norms. For example, some scholars have said that Jews, for example, have very few teetotalers, but they have very few alcoholics because their culture doesn't accept the idea that you lose responsibility when you're drunk. You're still responsible for your actions, whereas many other cultures, in different ways, that once you've imbibed, that it is understood that you will cease to be as responsible for your action. Some of the effects of alcohol are direct on the body through the physiology, but they interact with how the culture prescribes at what point is it okay to lose control and do crazy things. And in the same way, different cultures will set different norms as to what is appropriate for you. And I would go to speculate wildly that the the countries and cultures that have been most successful in the world have managed to promote self-control to some degrees. I mean, one of the explanations for Britain's rise to prominence was the Industrial Revolution occurred there because of the emergence of a disciplined group of working-class people who had enough self-control to make the transition from farm work to factory work, where you had more roles, more tight control, and they could do that without breaking the equipment and so forth.
Does our level of self-control, I mean, once we are adults, does it change as we move through young adulthood and middle age into old age?
Well, the impulses change, so there are certainly differences with age in the outcomes. Now, whether that changes your capacity in the sense of your willpower, as I said, you can gain willpower at any time, and you can let yourself go at times, so there may be shifts in the long run. Probably the more important changes are on the other side. If you think self-control is for restraining yourself and the impulses are making you want to do things, well, the sexual and aggressive impulses that get people into a lot of trouble, they peak in adolescence and early adulthood and so diminish later. For example, almost no one turns to a career of crime, especially the regular old-fashioned kind of crime, after the age 30. It almost never happens. It's not because suddenly self-control is a whole lot better there, but that sort of impulse doesn't emerge at that point. The same impulses are there and they gradually weaken over time, or the person finds other ways of satisfying them.
I don't remember seeing this in the book, but do we tend to surround ourselves with people whose level of self-control is close to our own?
Well, that's a very interesting question. We have looked at friendships and romantic relationships. It appears in romantic relationships there's almost a pattern of opposites attract. There's a bit of a tendency for the kind of straight-laced, disciplined person to be attracted to the carefree, fun-loving, spontaneous type, and vice versa. And so people do pair up in romantic ways a little bit that way. The success of the relationship is better if both of them are higher in self-control. But there's some attraction that goes the other way. In other kinds of friendships, we found no pattern that does not seem to be, you can be good friends regardless of each other's level of self-control. Although, again, the success of the relationship in the long run may depend on higher self-control in both. So there might be a tendency in the long run to sort that way, but it doesn't appear to be a strong factor in selecting friends.
Roy F. Baumeister is director of the Social Psychology Program at Florida State University. His new book is called Willpower, Rediscovering the Greatest Human Strength. It's written with New York Times science columnist John Tierney. Roy, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you very much, and I hope your listeners have enjoyed it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.